I was quite struck the other day. I was looking at some discussion about the episode you may have heard, this very famous episode of Paul, who became one of the great saints of Christianity, and of course he used to persecute the Christians, and then he had this experience when he was on the road to Tarsus. And this commentary, this kind of Oxford Bible commentary, was discussing the interpretation of this event. And I was quite struck by the way that it discussed it in terms of various kinds of historical and doctrinal and theological propositions and dogmas, as if some kind of event like this had to be a kind of a way of balancing somehow his Jewish heritage with the ideas of Christianity and so on and so forth, or how he interpreted Jesus' teachings or whatever. And it didn't seem to cross their minds to interpret it or to consider the mystical dimension of this kind of experience, of actually literally seeing the light. Because this is something which is quite separate, quite different, what we actually see in some kind of mystical experience or meditation experience is quite different, quite separate from how we interpret it, what words we use to wrap it up in. And I think this is one of the great distinguishing points of Buddhism, is that I think this kind of experience is common to all religions, and similar kinds of things are described in all religions, but in Buddhism the way that it's talked about, the way that it's understood, is quite distinctive. For example, you know, you can imagine if a meditator is sitting down to meditate, say a Buddhist meditator, and they see a bright light, a bright stable light that comes up shining like the sun in their meditation. They say, wow, that's amazing. They come out and see their meditation teacher, and the meditation teacher says, okay, well yes, this is what we call a nimitta, you need to stabilize this and develop it. If a Christian meditator was to see the same thing, they'd probably come out of meditation and say, I've seen the face of the Lord, yeah? This is the face of God that I've seen revealed to me. This sense of overwhelming power and mastery and light. So you interpret it as being the face of God. So all the other Christians, I imagine, would say sadhu, sadhu, and think that it must be a great saint. Just like if you're in Buddhism and you can see and get a good nimitta, people think of you as a good meditator. And the Buddhist meditator may be encouraged to go deeper and then becomes unifies with this light. Not just seeing the light anymore, but becoming one with it. What would happen to the Christian meditator who that happened? They'd come out of it and they say, before I saw the face of God, now I am God. At this point they get strung up as a heretic. So I don't know whether that actually happened in Christianity, but this is kind of how you know, we can understand that the progress, these kinds of experiences, that's what they feel like. And in fact, according to Buddhism, that's quite accurate. That's what it is. That's what God is. If God is anything, God is a powerful being who's been produced through the power of these kinds of meditation experiences. And so it's quite accurate to say, yes, this is what the face of God is like. It feels like this overwhelming creative energy that can actually create the whole world. And the reason it feels like that is because it is. It is this overwhelmingly powerful creative energy that can create the whole world. But it doesn't create the whole world in the sense of once upon a time in the beginning and God created the world and set it in motion. It creates the world in the sense that right here and now our minds, our consciousness sustains the existence of our own world. What we see from our own consciousness, this is sustained and built up from this energy of the mind. So we think about this and reflect this. All of those things in our world, think of how complex our worlds are, how complex our lives are. The incredible dimensionality of it, the different kinds of emotional overtones, the physical aspects, even just the body, even just one part of the body, even just one cell in the body is so incredibly complex. Yeah? And yet every cell in the body has been in some way enabled and brought into being through the power of the mind. This is quite amazing to think about that incredible subtlety and energy that's contained in the mind that we gradually learn to unlock through meditation. Now, curiously enough, that most people's experience when they come to sit meditation is not of overwhelmingly powerful magical lights that appear, like the sun shining in the midday sun, or like the full moon glowing in the clear sky. That's not like 90% of Buddhist meditation experience. It's maybe like 1% or 10% or something like that of the meditation experience. Most people, our experience is, oh, I'm sitting down and lots of thinking, wandering thoughts here and there. Or moods, yeah, we get with moods of anger or restlessness or whatever it might be. Or pain, yeah, we're feeling pain in the body. Or like doubt, we're not sure what we're doing, we're confused and so on in the meditation. So these are the kinds of things which, you know, for most of us, most of the time, is where our meditation is at. And this was quite succinctly put by one Australian monk who's now disrobed, but when he was practicing at this very famous meditation centre in Burma, where it's quite renowned for people quite openly discussing their meditation attainments and various things. And one time the people asked him, well, have you attained to anything in your meditation? He said, yes, I have. And they said, oh, really? Sadhu, sadhu, what have you attained to? He said, I've attained to the five hindrances. So that's quite honest, isn't it, you know? And certainly can't blame him for being boastful or anything. But also very realistic, and it's important to recognize that this is what the content of our meditation is, and it's dominated by these things we call the five hindrances. First one, sensual desire. It means we're wanting stuff, wanting experience, wanting pleasant experience through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. But especially through the five senses, through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. We can also have sensual desire through the mind, but that's like channel wants, it wants to experience through the body, through physical sensations. So this is the first of our hindrances. So this is something we need to understand, we need to look at. It's accepted as a truism in the world that greed is dangerous and harmful, okay? Unless we're sort of working on Wall Street or something like that, and kind of the famous saying, greed is good. But the reason why that saying, greed is good, became famous was because it's so counterintuitive and it's so against what actually the world knows and understands and believes most of the time. We understand that actually moderation is good. And this has consequences on the global scale. Yeah, we know global warming, being a very obvious example, is a phenomenon which is driven basically entirely by greed. It's by this relentless desire to consume, to have anything, to have exactly what you want, and to not really care at all what the consequences of that are. It's actually relatively easy technologically and practically to overcome the dangers of global warming. There's no particular problem as far as the science is concerned or anything like that. The problem is people's greed. They don't want to change their lifestyle. They don't want to consider others. They don't want to have to adapt. They don't want to acknowledge the fact that their actions have an impact beyond their own sphere. And this is really the problem. And so, to address the problem of global warming, we need that kind of will or that kind of consciousness which is able to look out from one's own desires and actually appreciate the impact of that in the larger sphere. Now, that kind of ethical thinking and way of looking at things is part of what we mean or we speak of in the West in historical terms when we think about what we call the Enlightenment. And so I don't want to go too much into the history of all this, but this period of the Enlightenment in the West was where a lot of the great ideas which define modern Western philosophy, like our freedom and democracy and so on, equality, equal rights and so on, these kinds of ideas came very much to the forefront of philosophy and thought in Europe. And it's interesting, just from our current perspective, that metaphor was used, the metaphor of enlightenment. Yeah, it was like shining a light. And one of the great insights at that time was simply that insight into understanding that we are one humanity, and that what we do has consequences, and that we have to think of other people in making our acts. Of course, this was not new at that time, and is one of the insights of all the great religions, is found expressed in many times, many religions, and often known as the Golden Rule. And one of the most famous teachings of the Golden Rule was by the Rabbi Hillel, who lived about 150 years before Jesus. And one time Rabbi Hillel was asked by his students, and his students said, you know, here you are teaching us the Jewish law, and it's so complicated and so convoluted, and all these rules and regulations and everything like that. If you can recite the entire Torah, the entire Jewish law, while standing on one leg, then we'll become your followers. So he stood up on one leg and said, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. This is the entire Torah. Everything else is commentary. Go and practice it. It's very beautiful. And it's just such a wonderful approach to religion, isn't it? And everything else is just commentary, okay? So take it or leave it. But that's the essence, and that's the really important thing. So when these ideas began to manifest through the Enlightenment philosophers in Europe, we call this the Enlightenment. This bringing of light, shedding of light. And so again, this is how we approach also to the inner world, yeah? Through restraining our desires, through understanding that we do not reach happiness just by following our desires. We do not create a beautiful and good world simply by trying to get everything that we want. By doing these things and restraining, then you're restraining that first hindrance. You're creating a more beautiful world around yourself, and you're also restraining that first hindrance. So whether that operates in the spheres, for example, of sexual relations, in terms of being content, okay, not being excessive in, or promiscuous and so on in your sexuality. And again, this leads to a degree of coolness and contentment in the mind. It relates to use of drugs and alcohol, all of these kinds of things, or the pursuit of just buying lots of stuff. When you get depressed or upset, then making yourself happy by going shopping and getting some new stuff. And so this unity, or this reflection between the inner world and the outer world, yeah, this is very strong, and this is what I want to emphasize here. The second hindrance is the hindrance of ill will, and it's like the opposite pair. Greed and hatred follow each other. And we can see that in the way that the world is operating today, with the wars that are going on. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are often motivated. It's difficult to work out which is the greater motivation. Is the greater motivation greed? Are they after oil and so on? Or is the greater motivation hatred? Is it just a lack of understanding and empathy with fellow human beings? Yeah? And wanting to exterminate somebody else's civilization. These two things go hand in hand. And if there's enough greed, then the greed will find a reason to stir up hatred. And this is what we've seen in all of the wars throughout history. You know, if we look in the First World War and so on, then there was this incredible effort to sort of characterize the Germans as being, you know, subhuman and brutal and all of these kinds of things. So whenever we're at war, we always want to characterize our enemy in the most evil terms. And this hasn't changed. We still see this today, this drastic attempt to portray Muslims and Arabs and Iraqis or whatever as being, especially Islamic religion as being somehow intrinsically wrong or bad or something like that. And we forget that there's been tremendous contributions made by Islamic people throughout history. And just to mention one example is, I can't remember his name now, but he was the leader of the revolutionaries in what is now Pakistan. in the time of Mahatma Gandhi. And actually, while the movement up until then had been quite a violent resistance movement against the British, but then after he met Gandhi and came under his influence and worked together with him, they formed a very, very powerful non-violent resistance movement, to the extent that these very strong warriors and so on would be beaten and humiliated, totally humiliated by the British. Many of them were killed, they were thrown in jail for long periods of time, and all of these kinds of things, and then they would not resist or react in any way. And when they were asked about where they found the strength to do this, they'd say that they found the strength to do this through their understanding of what the essential message of Muhammad the Prophet was. So this is not a fairy tale, this isn't something that just happened an incredibly long time ago. It's only a couple of generations ago it happened, and it helped to form the nations of Pakistan and India that we know today. And so this is what can happen when we overcome this hindrance of ill will. Again, that anger we see within ourselves, yeah? When we're driving a car, right? Road rage, you've all felt it. You've all felt that anger when somebody pulls in front of you or anything like that. This is the same thing. Don't excuse yourself, all right? Don't excuse yourself, don't excuse that anger. This is the same thing that causes terrorism and wars and all of these kinds of things. So there's again this inner and this outer reflecting each other all the time. And a third of the hindrances is sloth and torpor. And this also is very important to remember that the mind is purified and made bright and powerful through applying energy, through actually working it, yeah, and not through just being lazy. And this also is very, very important for us to remember, both on the inner sphere and on the outer sphere as well, that we don't create a good world, we don't live in a good world just by not doing anything. It's not good enough for us to simply not be oppressing somebody if we're just acquiescing and being silent in the face of oppression. We have to actually speak out and make our voice heard, try to do what we can to help, and to do things like using Buddhist ideas, like Sinsin was talking about earlier with Mitra, to use Buddhist activities to actually create charitable works to help people who are in need. All of these kinds of things are very, very wonderful, because they're acknowledging that link, which we can't deny, between the inner world and the outer world. And that we need to make that effort. It's not, we can't just let the world go by. We need to really try to do this. And this is that essential thing, quality in Buddhism. Viryena dukkhamacceti, the Buddha said. It's because of energy that one crosses over wisdom. Sorry, one crosses over dukkha. Not one crosses over wisdom, one crosses over suffering. Through energy, viryena. And of course it's energy which lights the mind up as well. Just like it's the energy in the light bulb which lights it up. Yeah, it makes it radiant, and then we can see things. So it's through this energy, and we need to put forth that energy in our practice, in our meditation practice. Very constant, very steady, and not just giving up when things become difficult. Next one is restlessness. And this also is a very, very important one. Very often we want results too quickly. Yeah? We think that if we try hard, then we can get results very quickly. And I think this is unfortunately encouraged by the kind of the modern phenomenon of having like intensive meditation retreats, where you think that you go for a couple of days or a couple of weeks or something on intensive retreat, and that will somehow do it for you. And I see this again and again and again, that people kind of think in this way. And I never encourage it. You see them a few months later or something, and then they come back, and to be honest, they usually don't really get anywhere. I mean, you have some nice experiences on meditation, and then you come out, and then it falls away. I find it difficult to see people who really benefit long term from that kind of practice. I'm not saying that the practice is wrong, but I'm saying it's the expectations that we have around it. We think that these things are going to solve our problems. They're not really going to solve our problems. It's not by going somewhere else some other time and going into that kind of situation for a short period. It's not really going to do it for us. This is restlessness, a lot of restlessness there. And this is also also very important in when we're dealing with things in the outer world as well, that often we think we can solve problems too much by doing things and by forcing them rather than observing and then letting them find their own solution. And I was just reading about this this afternoon in the train on the way here, and they're talking about the non-violent revolution in the Czechoslovakia when they overthrew the communist regime, and it all kind of started with the student uprising in 1968. And even though the actual revolution wasn't until 1988 or 89 that they actually overthrew them, it was still the same people that were involved in some cases, that were still the same who had been the students in 68. And they were said, well, they were just being patient, they knew that they would win eventually. And they said, and it was very interesting because they were asked, you know, was there anything that surprised you about that revolution? They said, well, yes, what surprised us was that it happened so quickly. You know, it was only 20 years, and I thought it would take a lot longer than that. Yeah? So that's very, very beautiful to show you that that's what it takes. It's that kind of patience. And many people, when in that situation, would fall back on then, you know, seeking a violent outcome. So, you know, you see the same situation, for example, with the Tibetans and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he keeps on insisting on not using violence to try to get the Chinese out of Tibet. And he faces quite a lot of kind of stirrings among the more kind of radical or energetic or younger Tibetans, maybe, who are very frustrated with the apparent lack of change. But to see that over that long term, yeah, to seek that non-violent solution will always be healthier in the long term, no matter what we have to endure in the meantime. So, restlessness, and then the last one is doubt. The last one of the hindrances is doubt. So this is like not really knowing what you're doing and being unclear about it, worrying about it. And it's important to have a degree of confidence. If you're learning meditation, to have that element of confidence and faith in what we're doing. Remember, like, meditation is not an experiment, right? It's not something which we're just kind of making up and saying, oh well, you know, this will, I reckon this is going to be good, you know. It's something which is very tried and true, yeah. It's very been practiced for so many thousands of years. Now, of course, the details of it, yes, is flexible. We need to be flexible and open in exactly how we approach meditation, and that's very individual. But the basic principles of it have been established for such a long period of time, and nobody's really been able to better them, yeah. And it's like the kind of the shape of the wheel, you know. Once you've worked out, oh well, we make wheels round, we don't make them square or pentagon or anything like that, you make them round. And once you've figured that out, then you can't get any better than that. It's the perfect shape. So meditation is like that. Even though the way we talk about it, the way we describe it, the way we teach it, those things can change and alter. But the basic technique has been going for such a long period of time, and so many thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people have practiced these things and benefited from them through history. And so we should always reflect on that and never worry about it, never be doubting about the practice itself. The practice will lead to the result, but we need to have that patience. If we have the patience, we keep going, we'll get there eventually. And so we come back to this theme of light. So we say this, the light is the mind when it's freed from these five hindrances. And the little Pali phrase which I recited at the beginning of the talk, Pabhasarang idam bhikkhave cittam tanca agantukehi upakilesehi upakilekam, which means that this mind is radiant, but it is defiled by transient defilements. And so this is a saying which is often misquoted. That's probably one of the most misquoted sayings in Buddhism, and it's usually misquoted as saying that the mind is naturally radiant, okay? Which is not what the sutta was saying at all. What the Sutta is saying is that the mind is radiant. This mind is radiant. Okay, now that whole sutta is given in the context of talking about what they call citta bhavana, is development of the mind, i.e. development of the mind through meditation. Now, what it's saying is that when the mind is developed, then it is freed from these transient defilements. When the mind is undeveloped, then the transient defilements envelop it and darken it, like the clouds will darken the sky. But when it's developed in the proper way, then it's clear, just like the sky is clear. So then you can ask the question, is the sky naturally clear? Right? Is the sky naturally blue and clear? Or is it naturally covered by clouds? Well, of course, the nature of the sky is to be sometimes blue and sometimes covered with clouds. That's all. That's the actual nature of it, is to be affected by conditions, yeah? So this kind of saying, you can say, well, the mind is naturally radiant. Well, it doesn't really solve the problem. It doesn't really address the problem. Another way of looking at it, we were talking about this the other day because we were talking about cleaning the office. And so I said, oh, don't worry, the office is intrinsically clean. Right? And the office itself is intrinsically clean. It's just this transient dirt and so on, which is just passing through it. Yeah. So, you know, so therefore, what does that mean? Therefore, we don't have to worry about the transient dirt, because we can. It's only your defiled mind which is focusing on the negative, right? And it's just looking for faults all the time, okay? And if only you were just able to see the nature of the office as being intrinsically pure and clean, then there wouldn't be a problem. That didn't really win the day, unfortunately. My argument was defeated, but but that's, you know, that's when you see what it is. It's actually, is the office naturally clean or not? Well, the office is clean when somebody cleans it. If they don't clean it, then it gets dirty. So it's the nature of the office to be affected by conditions. Yeah? If there's a tidy person working in there, it's kept clean. If there's an untidy person, like myself, working in there, then it gets dirty. So that's the nature of the office. So the mind is the same. The nature of the mind is not to be radiant. The nature of the mind is not to be dark or defiled. The nature of the mind is to be conditioned. And this is the really important thing. The nature of the mind is to be conditioned. So when the conditions are there for the mind to be pure, then the mind becomes pure. When the conditions are there for the mind to be defiled and dirty and horrible and disgusting, then the mind is all of those things. So the mind is capable of anything at all. And so this is what's so amazing about it. It's not that it's intrinsically one thing or the other, but that it's so incredibly changeable and incredibly flexible. So through our meditation, we gradually learn to clean out our mind. And as we do that, we have this, as the defilements become less, the hindrances become less, we have this impression or this feeling that there's this light appearing in the mind. It's almost like we see with our inner eye, we see this light, we see this sense of radiance. And it appears to us, it's just the same way as light does outside. So much so that you can quite easily mistake it for being light outside. You can be sitting there with your eyes closed in meditation and you're not really sure whether somebody switched the light on outside or not. It appears to you exactly the same. Okay, and sometimes you might sort of open your eyes to check whether someone's turned the lights on. You go, oh no, they haven't. They close it and then the light's gone already. So these kind of things happen, but that's how it appears to the mind. Now of course there's no light there. So what's going on? What's going on is that the mind is using a metaphor, okay, to represent its own purity. Okay, I'll repeat that. The mind is using a metaphor to represent its own purity. In other words, the mind is acting like a poet, and the mind is speaking to us like a poet and then saying, I'm now bright and shiny, like the sun is, or like the stars are, and it's creating that image in your mind. It's speaking to you in that language of metaphor. In a similar way that the mind, say for example in dreams, also will communicate through using metaphor and symbol. Okay? So we think of it like that, like the mind is communicating to us, like reflecting. Yeah? So we're looking, we have a feeling, when you're in meditation, we have a feeling like, oh, I'm in here, right? And looking out, this is subjectively how it feels like, I'm in here and I'm looking out. and I'm looking out and I'm seeing this light, I'm seeing this radiance, and it's almost as if that radiance is coming to me from outside. But this is actually the mind creating this idea of light. And of course it works in terms of light because the mind's been programmed in that way since very, very early. So you think very, very basic to the mind, even if you think back in evolutionary terms to when we were rodents or whatever we were in, you know, evolutionary, long time ago, you know, we would be, that difference between the day and the night was actually crucial to our survival, yeah, to be able to tell the difference between day and night. Even plants can tell the difference between day and night, yeah. Very, very crucial aspect of perception. Fundamental to our whole, the way that our mind is wired, the way our brain is wired. And so we learn that in the daytime we can see how things are. At nighttime we can't see how things are. We're confused. The nature of things is confused. The nature of things is uncertain. And the Buddha described this very well when he's talking about his own practice in the Vahebhairava Sutta, and saying, you know, he'd be sitting all alone at night in the middle of the forest and he'll hear a twig snap and he'll be startled and full of fear. What's that moving in the forest? And then he realizes, oh, it's only a peacock. Yeah? But he thinks it's some kind of deadly animal, because the mind is creating these things. So that's the essence of nighttime, is to create these kinds of confusions in the mind. Daytime we see things as they are. And so the mind, when it starts to become clear, when it starts to become sensitive, when it starts to know better, it starts to be able to exercise its function of knowing in a more powerful, more clear way, then it describes that to itself as being like a light. Okay, so this is why in the commentaries in the Visuddhimagga it says that this kind of light that we experience is sanyaja, is born of perception. Okay, so it's this perception of light. There's no actual real light, but it's perception. So when we're meditating, as the meditation becomes stronger and clearer, the light becomes more steady, more steady, more steady, more steady. And at a certain point it will change and become very strong and powerful. Now, as a practical tip for meditators, it's very important that we don't get distracted by lights that appear in our meditation. So this is very, very important. There's really two kinds of, broadly speaking, two kinds of light that we can see in our meditation, okay? One of them is the light or the nimitta that's associated with the meditation object that we're actually developing, okay? The other kind of light is everything else. And so the key difference is the light that's associated with the meditation object comes up within the meditation object itself. So there's an experience of unity there. It's with that meditation object. It's not somewhere else. Now, very commonly, as the mind is starting to become pure, it will start to maybe see things. There'll be lights will appear at a certain place. Maybe light will come out of the distance towards you. Or maybe you'll see visions of things. Some people see visions of maybe heaven or hell realms or all different kinds of things. So there's certain kinds of meditators tend to see these things. And often they're very alluring, or it could be anything that you're seeing, and it becomes very, it's very interesting because these images become very vivid and very powerful. But it's important to ignore all of this kind of stuff. None of that's important. None of that's the path. Okay. Always focus back on your meditation object. And if you find that these things are starting to happen, ignore them, and get concrete and grounded on your meditation object. And this is why when I'm teaching metta meditation that I'm always emphasizing that you have to keep it focused inside your body. Keep it grounded inside your body. The same if you're doing breath meditation, you need to keep it grounded on the physical feeling of the breath. Keep it based on that as long as you can to make your mindfulness very strong on that. Then if you can do that, the light comes up inside the meditation object, and that's the one that we want. We want the one that's not separate from your meditation. We want the one that comes up inside and changes your meditation object, transforms it, makes that come alive, makes your breath turn into a mass of light, like a river of light. That's the one that we want, not the one that leaves the breath down here and then appears out here. So if you can focus and focus, 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 focus on that carefully and consistently, then eventually the light changes. And what's called the technical term is the paribhaga nimitta arises. And this paribhaga nimitta is extremely powerful and bright. This is what I was referring to earlier when I said that if you're looking at it from a theistic point of view, you would say, this is the face of God. And you'd be right, that is the face of God. And it appears, that's how powerful it is. Okay? That's what you need to do. You need to keep on developing it until you get an nimitta that comes up that's that powerful. Okay? And then this is where we start to go into the realm of what we call samadhi in Buddhism. Okay? Also very important to remember that none of what I've been talking about so far has anything to do with the Buddhist idea of quote-unquote enlightenment. All right? I mentioned it a little bit earlier, the European historical phenomenon, what they call the Enlightenment. Now, when the European Indologists, especially T.W. Rice Davies, started to translate Buddhist terminology into the West and started to interpret Buddhist ideas in the West, he had to use, of course, the language and ideas that were available to him. And so one of the renderings that he chose, where he rendered the Buddhist idea of Bodhi, he rendered as enlightenment. And he was actually, you know, quite consciously trying to evoke that idea, that European idea of the enlightenment. But it's really quite a different kind of thing. European enlightenment was really like a set of ideas. Yeah, it was like an idea or conceptual level, which had like a political and social dimension, whereas enlightenment in Buddhism, or Bodhi in Buddhism, is something that manifests as an inner realization. So they're not really comparable. But, and in addition, the etymology or the meaning of Bodhi doesn't really have anything to do with light. And so often, in more modern times, a lot of translators have preferred to render it as awakening, rather than enlightenment, awakening being more literal, much more literal, so to wake up. And this is the meaning of Bodhi. So it's important to remember, the practical point to remember here is that enlightenment is not, has got nothing to do with seeing lights. Alright? So what, that whole realm of the lights and stuff that you see in your meditation in Buddhism is in that realm of what we call samadhi. Okay, so that's part of Buddhist practice, yeah, part of the meditation practice, it's very important, but that's not the actual realization of Dhamma. So whenever any of those things happen to you, you need to, when they pass away, when they end, just to reflect on that, to reflect on the fact that they're conditioned, that they came into being for certain reasons, at a certain time, for certain causes and conditions because of my practice, and now they've passed away. You can just watch that, watch them ending. Watch the light ending. And watch that feeling in the mind that, oh, I'm going to get it back. This is the next thought that arises, and the next thought is, oh, I want a bit some more of that, that was quite nice. Yeah, so you've got to watch that as well. Yeah, and so this is where your wisdom will come up. Yeah, the wisdom will arise through this. So this is my little talk for this evening on light in Buddhism and enlightenment and some of the different dimensions of that within meditation. So I offer this to you for your reflection and your enlightenment.